So maybe you should describe again, what is optimization? And let's also see if we can now relate to somebody who doesn't own a business, who right now might be in trance going, this is really wonderful, but I don't own a business. I work for somebody else. How do we make that happen?
First thing is optimization, in my mind, is the process of getting the maximum yield for the maximum duration of time from the minimal investment from everything you do today, in the future, and this is really interesting, from everything you've ever done in the past. And from everybody you everybody and everything you ever come in contact with. Not just your business, your current and your past employees, your vendors, your current customers, people you don't sell, suppliers, distributive lines, your location you're at, everything. So start with that premise. Here's a quick summary take on my theory. Until and unless you can form a clear and distinct and accurate picture of what your vision for the business has to look like at the end. And I don't mean when you die or when you sell it. I mean when you get to wherever you're trying to go.
Right.
Until you have that clear and defined and not abstract, not just successful.
Precise outcome.
Exact. Precise outcome. You can't possibly build or fulfill or achieve your dream for that business. And the trick or the secret to building your vision is to master this art of optimization. Optimization is learning how to maximize, not minimize, every asset. And keep in mind, the greatest assets you have in your business are not on the books. They are intangible. We'll get into that in a few minutes. Every contact, every opportunity, every relationship, every distributional channel, every employee, every piece of capital or human capital you have. Most people I have observed minimize instead of optimize.
And right now, the business environment demands this. This is why we're seeing companies that are downsizing, that are re-engineering the corporation, saying, let's look at every part of our business and figure out how to do it more efficiently than we've ever done it before.
Exactly. Most people don't even identify or recognize all the areas or opportunities or options or pillars, as you say, for optimization that are available to their business, because all they have as a point of reference is what they do in their business, this tunnel versus funnel vision. You can't optimize until you first recognize the assets, the opportunities, and the options available. If you don't know what's possible, you can't be expected to do it. So you got to, first of all, stop and say, what is possible? How many better and other and additional ways could I be doing something that would work as pillars in my business?
So part of why people bring you in is because you tend to see or have multiple ways of looking at something like that based upon your background of working with so many different types of businesses, so many different types of industries.
I give it a CAT scan perspective based on a much broader knowledge base.
But people could also, just to be fair, because our outcome in this tape is also to certainly have people utilize your resources where appropriate, but also for them to realize that if they just start with a belief system, there are hundreds of other ways to do it, instead of continuing doing over and over again, because what they're doing is working at a certain level, just like the ad, or not working, that there are those other ways. If they don't change that mindset, it seems like nothing else really matters.
You're getting ahead of me, but that's exactly true. You must learn what strategies allow your business to take best and maximum advantage of the greatest opportunities you have. And again, this is part of this understanding and this acknowledging an awareness of how many other possible ways other people, other businesses outside your industry operate. I call this forming for yourself an optimal success strategy. And you can't forge an optimal success strategy until you first develop, as you said, a different philosophy to operate your whole business and life by.
Well, let me clarify something now, though. There are many things in your business which are not, they don't provide the maximum return, and yet all these small little returns.
Well, it's an integrated comment. You're right.
Okay.
It's like Deming said something. It's like certain parts of an enterprise may give their life for others. It's not, you can't be judged out of context. It's an integrated statement. Okay. In other words, I've had businesses where we purposely acquired new customers at a loss because we had analyzed the residual or the lifetime value, and we knew that every time we lost, like the Icy Hot example, $5, we really made $500.
Right.
Every time we gave a free service, we didn't really lose money, we accrued an incredible benefit. So you got to look at it in an integrated, either holistic or totalistic context.
Right.
Okay. So you got to form an optimal strategy. You can't do that till you develop a whole different philosophy to operate not only your business but your life by, because it forces you to be totally externally focused, totally, I'm going to use the word, service or benefit to other focused. And people have to realize that whether it's avaricious or not, the most self-serving thing you can do is to learn to be selfless.
Serve others, and no matter what you do to try and serve others and help others.
And subordinate totally
to your
own needs.
Right.
Okay, so you can't forge a better philosophy until you first change, and this is where you're brilliant, your mindset, replacing blocks and impediments and limiting beliefs with empowering ones.
Right.
Basically, people don't realize you're not playing the game for the moment.
Exactly.
You're playing it for forever. And when you look at it in that context, see, I've seen these very shallow thinkers think they're really astute because they made a little more profit up front, but they basically totally eliminated the residual effect. And the residual value is where all the wealth in life comes from.
And I think the ultimate residual value is the identity that you create in the marketplace.
I agree.
Because what people know about you and believe about you and what you do for them is what's going to ultimately give you the leverage to do whatever you want to do in your life. And you can't replace identity. You can create a better product or service, but if you have the identity, I mean, you look around, you can walk outside right now, and you can see a Plymouth Laser or a Mitsubishi Eclipse, and you can guess which one sells more, the Mitsubishi Eclipse.
Absolutely.
The bottom line is, they're the exact same car.
I know that, but it is.
They're a joint venture between these two companies, but people think Japanese equals quality, and they've consistently added so much value for such a small return.
I agree.
They've given us so much value that now we think we buy Japanese even when it's American.
It's all about
identity. So a lot of what you're saying in terms of being selfless is when you give that much value to people's lives, it builds an identity which makes people want to do business, tell other people about business, whether you're the realtor or whether you're icy hot, whoever it is in terms of the business. I want to come back to one thing, and I may have interrupted your flow. Let's come back to it. Let's talk about this in terms of a person who doesn't own a business, because I've talked about this several times, but I don't think we've really addressed it. How does a person build more pillars? How do they optimize? How do they really build a greater sense of certainty for their future by using these same principles? How do we put them in a position either within the company where they have multiple ways of being valuable to the company so the company's not going to down... I mean, when a company looks to downsize, they're looking at employees and they're looking from the perspective of who's adding the most value. Who can they afford to eliminate? Who can't they?
But it's not only who is, who do they see as adding value?
Yeah, now we're getting down to what marketing is. So let me ask you two questions. Question one. Finish optimization, but then tell me, what is marketing? Give us your definitions, as this whole topic has been about it. And then secondly, how do we use optimization and marketing if we don't own a business right now to have greater leverage in terms of our sense of certainty about our future?
Okay. You want me to finish this?
Yeah, go ahead and finish that first.
Okay. Where was I? We were talking about increasing or overcoming limiting beliefs, so it's great. All right. You can't adopt a superior mindset until you redefine the purpose and objective of your business from a customer or client benefit perspective. In other words, most people in business, they lost from the beginning. They're a self-fulfilling prophecy. They're mediocre in success and in fulfillment because their purpose is incorrect. It's erroneous. You got to basically set yourself up to understand what is the best and the highest and the most distinctive and the most valuable result or benefit or purpose my service or my company or my value added to that company or service can bring to you, the customer. Until and unless you understand and then redirect and refocus all your company's activities towards that outcome, you aren't going to get exponential.
Well, most businesses, again, are tending to focus on how to make a profit versus how do they serve the customer in the greatest possible way and the most profitable
way. But it's because they erroneously think that those are separate. They're not. They are absolutely the same function. Anyhow, you can't redefine your business's highest and best purpose until you decide to innovate, in my mind, because in its purest sense, innovation is the bringing or the adding of superior value to the end user. Doesn't matter. If you innovate in your factory, it's useless if it doesn't bring an advantage to the end user.
Right.
You may have a
brand. So it might bring a price advantage to the end user, potentially.
But that's fine.
Okay.
But if it doesn't, a lot of times people do things, but they don't pass the advantage on to the customer, so I guess they think that they're basically making more profit. But sooner or later, if you don't bring an innovation-based benefit on a continuous basis to your customer, you won't keep their patronage. Okay?
That makes sense.
Okay. You can't add value to someone, or someone can't see you adding value until and unless they understand and appreciate what you're doing, what you've done, what you will do differently, more beneficially for them, and that requires better marketing because, Tony, in its purest sense, marketing is two things. It's the continual educating of a customer or prospect for the life of that customer on the advantages and benefits and self-serving to them results your company or your service brings them that no one else does or can or will. And it's the intelligently formulated process of increasing their demand or desire for your product or service. And finally, it's the strategic process of bringing them to closure and to completed action.
So what we're really talking about in marketing is, I like the definition you said, it's a lifelong process with the customer, because that presupposes we're going to have an ongoing relationship. But it's educating them as to what do they get by working with us versus anybody else, and then the process of using that education to increase their desire for our product. Is that it?
Well, not only their desire, but their appreciation. It's giving them a basis to discriminate in your behalf.
Interesting. Very interesting. So let's come back again to the individual now. How does an individual who doesn't own a business optimize or really build a Parthenon, if you will, for their financial life, for their business life, for their career?
It's very simple the moment you believe it's simple. All you got to do is put yourself in the position of your employer. Your employer is as scared as you are. Your employer, if it's privately owned, it's a man or woman or a group of investors who have sunk enormous amounts of capital and human capital into it. They are very eager to see that investment continue to pay out. They are hopeful it'll pay out long enough they can retire. They probably are very eager to see it pay out long enough they might even be able to sell it. As soon as you help give them their outcome, they will love you, treasure you, and never want you to leave. How do you do that? By identifying greater, more effective ways they can make their enterprise throw off greater profit. They can get more customers from the action. Just doing the same thing I suggest that any business owner do, but do it as a de facto business owner. Identify what they are. First of all, figure out how many other, better, more effective ways you can get customers. You can convert prospect to customers. You can increase the unit of sale. You can increase the frequency of sale. Other things you can do with customers or with prospects who are inactive. When you've identified what those are, go to your employer, and because you'll find once you understand these, they are so much more powerful by and large than anything your company is doing, that the moment or within a few weeks or months of implementing them, they bring such advantage to your business that you don't want to necessarily reveal them to your employer until you effect the right structure. You go to your employer.
And I assume that means economic structure for your added value.
That's right. And I'm giving you both sides of the transaction in this interview.
Great.
You go to your employer and you make them a very simple proposition. You ask them if on your own time you are able to identify, to organize, to implement in the most conservative manner so it's no threat to the company.
No risk.
No risk to the company. Processes, mechanisms, activities, efforts that will increase massively the amount of profit, sales, etc. that company gets, and keywords are all of them will augment. They will never supplant the business activities, the customer activities. It will only bring increased
value. You're adding more pillars, not taking away what they're already doing, which they're committed to and believe is the essence of their business.
If I can do that for the company, can I, if it makes a lot of money, can I get back a dime or a quarter for every dollar I make you? And if that's too rich, can I get back a nickel or a dime? And if that's too rich, can I get back an extra $5,000 every time I make the company X for as long, this is the key, for as long as it keeps working? Huh? And would you mind putting it in a simple letter for me, sir? Or ma'am, as the case may be?
So all about adding value. And again, if you're doing that continuously, and even if you, in some cases, some people might choose not to ask for compensation, but just add the value so that it become invaluable to the company.
But that's only one, yes. That's why I'm going to get a little sexier with it, if I may. Well, you do it
Please do, Jay. You are so sexy. What can
I say? It's a pretty interesting
concept.
It's a pretty interesting concept, because The basic premise is presuming and assuming you're going to bring things in. But that's only, think of it as a dual valve, because you can export things too. Most companies, if you look at any business, we talk about processes, almost every business has at least one in multiple aspects of it where their processes are more effective, more powerful, more profitable, more efficient, more productive than anything else in their industry or in similar industries. Cases in point. Certain companies have got their manufacturing structure down where they get greater efficiency per hour or per manpower or per 100 square feet. They get less wastage. They've got greater ways to do things. They have greater tax advantages. You can take those techniques that are being used internally and you can license or sell or rent those to other people outside of
your... Give us an example.
Well, I'll give you two examples. I had a car wash one time. The guy came to me to try to improve his sales. In looking at his operations, I realized that his process of getting people to take the hot wax and all the other options was about 3 times better than almost any other car wash in the country. And I said, why don't you sell that technique to other people? And he reluctantly tried, and he ended up getting 1,000 car wash facilities to pay him. I think it was like $100 a month to use his way of articulating the option of the wax so that like 3 times as many people took the wax option. That was all profitable. I had a realtor one time who was a very hot realtor who sold 3 offices to a big like Coldwell Banker or Remax or Century 21, and she was great at listing. She was great at listing. And she was sitting on her thumbs trying to figure something to do after she sold her business, and I got her to take the technique she used to list and teach other people outside of the... And she, the first one she did, she made $60,000 in 3 days teaching people at $1,000. Do you want more? I mean, I've got... So the point is, within your company, if you look at the way your company operates, chances are every company, they've never thought about this because it's just the way they do business. They either sell better. They have ads that maybe they don't even use anymore that pull better on average than the industry norm. They have better closing mechanisms. They have a higher frequency of repurchase, a higher unit of sale. They operate the manufacturing facilities more effectively, more profitably, with less downtime, with less wastage. They get greater yield per employee or per dollar or per hour. They have greater, more efficient delivery. They have a lower or higher what's called CSI or customer satisfactory index. They've developed techniques that give them legal tax loopholes they don't know about. All of those processes can be standardized and can be sold or licensed or trade or leased or contingency made access to people for monthly fees, for buyouts, for percentages. You can do that for your employer and set up a profit center that can make tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, and you can set yourself up with the right proposition and the right structure and the right signed agreement to get that revenue residually forever, even if you quit your job. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense.
I mean, that's just one way, but there's tons of ways you can, and you don't have to do it there. You can do it also for other people. You can buy and sell concepts. You can be a brokerage firm. I mean, so the idea is, how many more ways can you make? And by the way, I'm talking predominantly in a money making. I've just given the one aspect of your company. There's a flip side. How many ways can you get your company more efficient? Because their idea of downsizing is very limited. Most entrepreneurs don't have the slightest understanding of all kinds of ways to reduce their costs, to improve their productivity. And I was just talking in the first segment of this interview about ways to increase sales. Well, the flip side, there's all kinds of things. If you just improve such things as if you reduce attrition, which is the loss of customers, or conservation, which is the retention of customers, a 10% reduction in loss, and most people don't even measure how many customers don't come back, but it's if you look at your inactive customers, how many new customers come, how many buy this year, how many didn't buy that were on the customer list last year, that alone can increase your sales. All you do is look at other ways you can bring your employer improvements, efficiencies, reductions that they wouldn't have done on their own, and you can ask for percentages of savings, of increased productivity. You can ask for bonuses. You can ask for that residually and not tie it to your job. And with a few simple phrases uttered on paper and sign, they can downsize you and terminate you, and you can still get a residual check for life. And what I've done with a lot of people when they did that was teach them to go to the employer and get a buyout.
Interesting. Oh, that's a great
idea. So they get a lump sum.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So in other words,
which they can maybe start a new business with.
That's right. Or get the employer to fund things for them, or give them space, or give them capital, or joint venture with them. It's all kinds of things you can do. It takes the ability to, what the Australians coined it, step outside the box, move outside your paradigm.
Maybe a good example of that I remember being shared with me was an example where I think you were talking to someone about the customers they weren't getting. They'd run some advertisement and people had not bought their product or service, and you turned around and said, well, that's a great opportunity. If they've not bought, they're not necessarily going to buy from you, but they're going to buy from somebody. Why not sell that to your competitors? You're even figuring out how to maximize or optimize the people that don't buy from you. Let's talk about that and relate that to, if you would, you know, thinking outside the box, so to speak.
Well, let's talk about upside leverage and optimization for a minute. People are limiting their, even if you understand what you think I said, you tend to think about it only in the context of your business. Think about it in the global expanse that there's all these people who don't have a clue what they're doing, business owners, competitors, if you will, complementary people and competitors who are spending enormous amounts of human capital and money bringing in prospects, bringing in customers, and you are too. So I believe that one of the greatest areas of opportunity and optimization and profit is in the people. People don't sell. I did a seminar one time, made $200,000 on this. I was selling a training program to put people into a certain kind of business. I went through Entrepreneur Magazine and saw two or three other people who had a similar training program. I went to them and asked them if they would let me furnish them with a letter they would send to their existing people who paid to go to their training. They refused, both of them. I said, fine. You have prospects who inquired and didn't convert? They said, sure, we got tons of them. I said, great. Will you sign a letter to them saying, in essence, this? We were gratified when you inquired. We were saddened you didn't take advantage of our training, but we realized there must have been one of a few reasons. Either the timing wasn't right, it was too expensive, or the opportunity didn't work for your skill set. If you're still wanting to go in business for yourself, there's only one other person we think might help you, and they recommended me. And I made $200,000 by getting them because I said those people didn't respond because they weren't interested in going in business. You either didn't have the right compelling offer, you didn't make the right proposition, your concept was wrong, your approach was wrong, your people were wrong. But they raised their hand for a reason. Right. I can give you more, but does that help you?
Yes, it does. So that's part of thinking outside the nine dots. What makes you think the way you do, Jay? I mean, what is it in your background? Tell us a little bit, you know, how do you become the marketing guru, per se? Where do you get this thought process that you have? I mean, now I understand you've had so many exposures to so many different businesses, but where did it start? I'd really be curious.
Well, it started very accidentally. I said to you earlier, I had a background being an absolute business transient. I've done so many unrelated things in my life. For example, I was a cost accountant. I sold electric shavers. I leased trucks for Hertz. I sold radio advertising. I ran and sold dry cleaning, uniform rental, and I bet you don't know what dust control is, do you?
No, I don't.
So here in the Midwest, you rent mats and mops to wipe people's feet in businesses so they don't traipse it over there. It's a very lucrative business. We did uniform rental. I was in the sway cleaning. I was in the 8-track stereo tape duplication business. I was in the real estate business. I was in the affinity travel business. I was in the association business. I was in the patent medicine business. I was in the chemical business. I can go on and on.
These were jobs?
Some of them were jobs. Some were part-time. Some were joint ventures. I said I had two kids when I was 20, and I have no college education, and I had to basically use my ingenuity and my agility. And sometimes one time I had three full-time jobs. No one knew it. They were all selling, and I made big profits at all of them because I always learned to deal with results, not time.
Right, so what you did is, rather than having salaries at those times, you got a percentage.
Everything was variable.
Out of value.
But what I realized, when I would leave a job, most people have a period of their life where they have an experience and they do something. Then a lot of people go to a totally unrelated field and they sort of turn off. They sort of compartmentalize and they relegate to the catacombs of the dusty past everything they've learned. I had this tendency to say, what did I learn about that situation that made sense? And I'll go back, for example. When I was in a cost accountant, I learned the lowest allowable cost of something. And I thought, that's interesting. When I sold shavers, I learned about co-op advertising. I learned about selling, that even though you had distributors, they never bought if you didn't sell through to a retailer. So dealing with distributors was almost a nuisance because they would not buy a lot unless you gave them orders, so you had to sell the end user. I learned that purchases weren't always made based on the viability. It was other things you gave them. For example, I'll tell you a funny story, how I sold $200,000 worth of shavers in Indianapolis at Christmas time. I was very curious. Most people need to be more curious, and curiosity and discovery is an external process. It doesn't occur if you stay limited myopically to what's going on in your industry. I studied everything, and I learned that billboard companies selling billboards, normally no one bought billboards from December the 15th to January the 15th. It was a dead time, and most everyone who bought up till then got free advertising through then, and the billboard companies hated it, but there's no buyers. Well, I also learned that in shaver advertising, you accrued co-op. You bought something, and the manufacturer would give you a matching funds based on certain purchases that they would pay 50 cents on, and you paid 50 cents up to a certain dollar. But most people didn't use it because the manufacturers had what I'll call tombstone ads that didn't sell, and most people didn't use it, and it dissipated. And if you didn't spend it, it accrued back to the manufacturer. I was the district sales manager for the city. I realized there was a lot of accrued, unused co-op advertising. That was point one. Point two, I realized there were all these billboards that weren't paid for, that weren't being used, and all these unhappy billboard companies. I went to the billboard companies and ended up to make a deal. I bought $200,000 worth of billboards for $10,000 cash because they were chagrined at all these advertisers who took advantage of them. I took the $200,000 worth of billboards, went to the biggest drug chain in Indianapolis, offered him $200,000 worth of billboards if they'd buy $200,000 worth of shavers.
Oh, my gosh.
They were excited, but I really, they would earn, the $200,000 of the shavers would have earned them $20,000 worth of co-op. So I ended up saving $10,000 on our co-op allocation in the process. But it's I learned various things as I went along. When I did ICIOT, I learned not only that you can get advertisers to accept performance instead of just a rate card, but I learned the value of the residual sale. I learned don't pay for advertising, pay for results. I learned to develop the back end. When I was in the lead generating business, I learned the four. You know the four critical factors of generating a lead that no one knows about?
Well, that sounds like a good idea. Give it to us now.
It's very fascinating. Most people don't understand. Everyone generates leads. A Yellow Page ad, a phone call is a lead. Somebody you meet. Leads have four critical factors. What they cost is only one. The conversion rate is the second factor. The unit of sale is the third factor. And the residual value is the fourth. Until you know all four of those factors, you don't know anything. People say, well, yeah, our leads cost us $25 or a new customer cost us $50. And that doesn't matter. What matters is what do they bring in the first sale? How often do they come back? What's the profit on them? Right. Until you analyze all those, a lot of people who generate leads, they don't even analyze them, but the few that analyze them, they standardize them all together. They say, well, a lead costs us $25, but you may have a lead coming from one source that cost you $100 that's 10 times more valuable than ones that cost you $5.
Right.
I learned all these things. I learned so many things. I became like the opening of the $6 million man. Do you remember that where they show the matrix or they show the grid where they got the computer things going sideways and down and crisscrossing.
Your brain looks like.
Well, it is. When I look at something, it's gotten to be automatic pilot. In the beginning, I disciplined myself to say, how many better ways? How many other ways? What have I learned from other people that could be applied? That's what I did. I did that consciously. Now, automatically, I look at it and it's a...
Because you have so many circuits you've already wired up for
yourself. And every time I work with another group,
Add to the references and distinctions. Sure.
Well, because I change. I do something no one else does. I don't conduct my programs. I make the participants conduct the programs. And as such, I learn as I'm teaching. Right. And all that's stored away. And every time I learn a new way, I learn how somebody else uses my techniques. I learn techniques I have, and I just file them away. And then I standardize them and categorize them now under the distinctions of these three ways to grow a business or the other categories, and it just sort of becomes natural. But it's not as complex. It can be taught very easily, as attested to the hundreds or thousands of people that have been able to successfully use it.
Well, part of it is, I know you're a Power Talk listener as well, and one of the most popular ones we've had is the power of questions. And really, thinking is nothing but the process of asking and answering questions. And you've asked questions that have helped you to take all these experiences, these references, and turn them into active, usable technology distinctions, things that can improve the quality of life. So I know you've often said that in business, people rarely, I don't think you say rarely, I think you say people just don't ask the right questions. What are the right questions we need to ask ourselves consistently in our business?
Well, okay, about your business, where is your business coming from? Most people have never analyzed the origin of their business, and it's a two-pronged question. Where new people are coming from and where repeat business is coming from, because this is trite, but the 80-20 rule is probably true. Probably 20% of your customers are bringing you 80% of your business, but you're not treating them special in two ways, acknowledgement or offering them more. If you know that one kind of a customer has a tendency to buy more often and higher tickets, you can program them to even more purchases. You can offer them products and services that not normally would be offered because they're too expensive to stock or produce. You might find, it's like in realtors, it's just funny, I analyze them and they knock on doors and they run ads and they do referrals and they do this, but when I ask them to go back and analyze regressively where the origin is, they'll find that 80% of their new business came from one or two categories, and yet they're not discriminating. They're spending the same or less time on those categories than they do on the rest. So the one thing is you can't optimize till you'd put the greatest effort and the idea is getting the best use of your time and your opportunity. Where do you get the best leverage on yourself and your business? I think you ask lots of questions and you keep going deeper and you ask as specifically as you can.
So give me an example when you say going deeper. What's your organizing principle for going deeper?
Well, I'll give you an example. I interviewed a number of realtors one time and they were very successful. They're the top 2% in the industry. And I said, well, what's your primary mode of selling? And they all said, referral selling. And I said, well, that doesn't mean anything. And I said, well, tell me what that means. And I started going deeper. How do you get a referral? Well, I asked them to give me some. I said, well, what do you say? And they were startled. And I said, well, I never thought about it. I said, well, what do you say to them? I said, how do you get them? How do you position them? What do they say back? What happens then? What do you do after that? After you ask them that, if they don't do it, do you follow up? If they do it, what do you do? If they do it, do you go back for more? I just kept going deeper and deeper and deeper. And the trick is to not be very specific and challenge yourself to specificity. Go deeper and deeper and deeper.
Coming back to the if you gave me three questions that every business person needs to ask consistently, you start out with the first one, which is, where is the origin of my business? Where is it really coming from?
Yep.
What are the other two?
Well, there's a couple questions. All right. Where is it coming from? Where could it come from? It's a similar question. Most people have no idea where their highest and best source of new business is. I mean that in a geographic, I mean it in identificational, I mean it in an approach. Number two is, who stands to benefit more than you by your being more successful? Most people don't ask that. And that opens up to lots of possibilities. First of all, customers, if you understand results. Second of all, suppliers, because sometimes you may be, relatively speaking, a greater beneficiary to a supplier than, I mean, you may be 80% of their business. They may be more motivated to fund, to help, to support you in growing your business, to run ads, to co-op, to advance money, to hire or cooperate on sales people to bring in if you don't have the money or the interest in doing that.
That's a great question.
Number three, who's in a position who already has my customers and has already sunk an enormous amount of effort, time, money, and action to get their goodwill and would be in the perfect position to recommend, endorse, or make them available to me with a positive predisposition? I mean, I can give you lots more questions, but those are three good ones.
Well, give me two more. You're on a major role here.
Okay. What other ways can I benefit from the goodwill I have with my customers in an ethical and beneficial manner to them?
And one more.
Okay. What ways can I better reduce the risk of the transaction, thereby getting more people lowered in their resistance barrier to take advantage of my product or service the first time?
That leads me to a very important concept. Let's talk about risk reversal. How important is that? What is it? And how can virtually any business use it to see an improvement in their ability to bring customers to the table initially and then continue to play in the future?
Okay. Well, first of all, how important is it? Well, do you want to stay in business and do you want to be competitively superior and do you want to be obscenely wealthy and successful? So first of all,
that's set up.
Okay. Understand this. In any business, well, any life encounter, but any business encounter, one side of the transaction is always being asked to assume all or more of the risk than the other. It may be done explicitly. It may be done implicitly. It may not even be consciously being done. But in every transaction that ever occurs in business and probably in life, one side is always being asked to take more of a risk than the other. To the extent you can recognize and acknowledge that fact, and you can eliminate and reduce or even make better than risk-free the transaction on the part of the prospective customer you're trying to induce to sample or avail themselves of your wares, you own the business. Let me give you an example because it's from the 19th century and it's a wonderful little story. A man wanted to buy a horse for his daughter. There were two horses for sale. One man said to him, buy the horse, take it home. If you don't like it, bring it back and I'll give you back the money. The other man, who understood risk reversal, said, my horse is kind, gentle, good, but I would say that it's my horse. Why don't we do this? Let me bring the horse to you. Let your daughter ride the horse for 30 days. I will even bring you the oats for the horse. I will come and send my son to clean up the debris the horse drops for the 30 days. At the end of that time, you decide whether the horse is suitable for your daughter. If it is, I will come then and ask to be paid. If it is not, I will come then and take it away from you at my cost. Now, which would you buy?
No question.
Well, I mean, that's a little bit graphically maybe strained, but that's the essence. Whenever you can doubt, here's the irony. Every business really guarantees the transaction by and large, because if there's a problem, they either make good on it or they give the money back or they give a replacement, but they sweep it under the carpet. I teach people to bring it to the top. Make it a condition, make it a powerful, very specific aspect of the selling transaction and not in the way of saying satisfaction guaranteed. That's like saying service, quality, dependability. I believe you denominate very specifically, you would call future pacing the outcome one should expect. You give somebody a matrix or a discriminator to impose on what their benefit, what their result should be. You tell them, look, Mr. Robbins, if this service doesn't make you 20% more effective, it doesn't reduce your this by 15%, if you don't sleep the happiest night you've ever slept, if you aren't more robust and healthy, if you aren't this, if you aren't that at the end of 30 days, and this is a trick, but it's an ethical trick, you have every right, if you like, to ask for your money back.
Interesting.
And it's a very powerful way. I believe in giving a better than risk-free proposition to most of my transactions. Basically, I want to make it, remember I told you about the coin where if you send it back, you get to keep, I didn't say, you get to keep the $100 worth of information, but you also get a $2 profit?
Right.
I want someone to be benefited so that at very worst, they come out advantaged for having at least taken a risk. They come out protected, advantaged, ahead of the game.
And what is your belief that guides that process? What's your belief about people and what they really need in that situation?
Well, I believe two things. That there's two kinds of people in business. Well, three. The people who actually render an incredible service and know it but don't tell it. There are people who actually render a great service and don't know it and don't tell it. And there are people who don't render a very good service or product. The latter, you can't do much with. They're not going to endure because the market will find them out no matter what.
Right.
And a risk reversal or guarantee is only going to help them the first time. In the repurchase cycle of life, they're going to get found out and they're going to fall out.
Because they're not adding enough value.
Okay. But the vast majority of people either do or can easily render such a superior service, or it can get their market to see them more distinctively or preemptively advantageous. But the only way to do that and make it easy is to. See, I think you acknowledge the fact that, hey, even though I know that what I do for you, let's use J. Abraham's service, even though I know what I do for you is going to produce a great outcome, it's going to make you more profits, it's going to reduce your expenditures, you're going to spend less, you're going to make more, you're going to have more fun, you're going to build more net worth, you don't know that. Even though I tell you 3,500 people who have experienced it, you for yourself don't know it. So I see it as my job, as my charge, as my responsibility, Mr. Robbins, to allow you to avail yourself of it, to preview it, to experience it totally at my risk. Why? Because if it works the way I say, you're not going to want to not continue, so I'll be benefited. If it doesn't, I don't deserve to keep your money anyhow, and that's the basis that I operate on.
Now, it's an interesting principle because I had a meeting recently with a gentleman named Joe Carey from Good Times Video, and they are the number one video producer in this country now in terms of actual gross number of units, not gross volume. I think Disney's a little bit higher than they are. They sat down with Walmart and said, we want to put you in the video business. And they said, here, Walmart, here's what we'll do. We'll come in and do a great job for you. We'll sell you a video for $10 and you can sell it for $15. And Walmart came back and said, no, you don't understand our business. You'll sell it to us for $5 and we'll sell it for $10. You'll send it to us, and you will not charge us. We will not give you a penny until we sell it. It'll basically be on consignment. You will pay for the space in which you place it. Not only that, but you will guarantee us a certain number of sales in that area by contract. And if we don't sell a product, you will pay not only for the shipping to get here, but you'll pay for us to ship it back to you. So Walmart has a bit of leverage in a relationship. Now, when they first
saw this, also know that they're going to sell a lot of units for people.
Because they're, whatever the number of people it is that go through a Walmart store, it's an insane number. And actually, I think he told me it was 60 million in a period of time. But anyway, the point of the matter is, he came away and said, that's insane. We can't do that. There's no way to do that. This is, you know, we can't be profitable. It can't happen. But he kept thinking about those 70 million or whatever the number, actual number is, that go through a Walmart store every day. And he said, you know, I could have trash in the front seat there and we're going to sell it if you've got 70 million people walking by it. So he began to think about this and he came back. And again, I don't remember the accurate number, but he represented to me that they went ahead and said, we're going to meet you on all these different levels and we're going to do more than that. We're going to put a space, since we're paying for the space, we want to design it because this is our expertise. We want to be able to come straight here and put it, not go through one of your buyers, but design how people are going to see these videotapes, when they're going to be there. We want to restock them directly. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, it cost them something like $10 or $12 million the first year, and they made no money. The second year, I think it cost them $7 or $8 million. This last year, which I think is their sixth or seventh year in relationship there, they made $500 million in business with a 25% net. And Walmart, not only if they serve Walmart so well and they have the information technology, the POS technology, to know the minute a videotape is sold, they know what videotape it was, what store, the minute it occurs, so they can keep track of what's most popular and replace it immediately. But they serve Walmart so well that Walmart has given them all their CD-ROM business for the future. And Microsoft said they wouldn't. They wrote a letter to, I had a chance to sit down with Bob Walton, who's, you know, the son who's taken over Walmart. And they sent him a letter saying, we're not going to work through this Good Times video with our CD-ROM business. And they sent a letter back saying, well, you think we're crazy, but a lot of people thought Sam Walton was crazy also. These people know how to serve us, and if you want to do business with us in all of our stores, you have to go through them. So they have wrapped up that business by serving their customer. By doing, in essence, they were told what the risk reversal had to be. Yeah. But they took it on, and they were willing to take what seemed like a loss in the short term because of the same principle you talk about. The back end for them is hundreds of millions of dollars.
Ask yourself this question. I'm going to get back because it's great. It ties everything together. You have choices of buying a product or service from five vendors. Four of them basically don't even mention guarantee or are very nebulous. One of them not only mentions it, but insists that be a condition of doing business. Insists you put them through the paces. Insists that that be the only way they sell to you. Helps you determine what your expectation minimally should be for you to be satisfied and get value. Which are you going to buy from? Now, people say, it's terrifying. I'm going to lose all my business if I do that. Well, because you can test anything small, and we'll talk about this in a minute,
okay.
And you can find out the answer and the risk or the opportunity on anything. It's very easy to test a risk reversal and never be compromised. You try it two or three or four times. You see how it increases. Remember you talked about baseline and variance, how it increases your baseline figures, your sales, your closures. Then you wait until the duration of time for the guarantee to expire and see what your incidence of refunds are or requests. But more importantly, the easiest way to do it is ask yourself this question. Does your product perform at the level you would promise? Most of them do. If it does, most people, when given a clear, more finite picture of what to expect on a denominated performance basis, see even greater advantage, see even greater value than just you're going to feel better. If I say you're going to feel better, that's one thing. If I say, Tony, you're going to sleep like you've never slept before. Your face is going to look radiant. Your eyes are going to sparkle. You're going to have three more hours of energy. Your wife is going to think you're incredible. In any way you want that to be interpreted,
see, all that would come across to me as hyperbole until you say, and if these things don't occur...
Within 30 days, as long as you do your part of whatever the regimen or the take the pill or follow the that's right, you got to denominate it specifically. It's not, but most people don't tie it all together. You got to really put your whatever on the line and be... But all you have to do is say this. What's my incidence of problems or refunds right this moment? And look and see what it is. Say, well, if that doubled, but my business doubled too, would that be a real problem? Because normally when you aggressively and powerfully and specifically and concertedly incorporate risk reversal into your selling platform, not just an aside at the end when there's a problem, but you bump it upstairs as part of the sales process you use, it will increase your closure rate massively. I can tell you, I have a client who's a founder of Federal Express. He used risk reversal and he increased his business quadrupled the first time he used it. I have another person who's the founder of the 33rd largest accounting firm in the country. He tried it to get clients and it doubled his closure. And the incidence of refund or unraveling was nil. But it presupposes you don't do it if you don't perform a great service. You don't denominate an expectation if you don't deliver it.
The other thing I think that happens too is when you make a demand upon yourself and the customer doesn't have to do it, they actually tend to probably soften on you more than get harder on you because they see that you're truly committed. They see the integrity in which you're operating within the business.
Right.
This brings up another issue, which is really, we've talked about earlier, the importance of creating a unique identity in the marketplace. You know, so that when someone thinks of that particular product or service or that industry, they think of you ideally. How do you begin to do that in your mind? If you put a client here and they say, you know, we're one of many, and you can pick any industry you want or example you want, but we're right now one of many, how do we develop or create a unique identity rapidly in the marketplace? What would you tell them would be the steps to take?
Well, first of all, I call that either unique selling proposition or unique selling advantage or unique selling distinction. And it's basically what people see as the benefit or the advantage you bring them more superior, more beneficially, more advantageously to their self-serving needs than anyone else. Depends on who you are. It's not a standard because it differs for different situations, okay. But it's a question of giving them what somebody else doesn't. And it can be a lot of things. Let's say you sell something hard versus something soft. Something hard is tangible. Something soft is services.
Okay.
If you sell something hard, you might throw something soft in with it free or very inexpensively to do it. You might double or triple the protection. You might do things other people don't do. They'll appreciate you and the performance of your product at a much higher level.
No question.
And their loyalty will be enhanced so, I mean, just it's amazing.
Tell me, as we wrap up here, let's get back to innovation for a second. You said you had a matrix for how to innovate, which is one of the primary ways to add value, create a unique identity. Mm-hmm. What is that matrix that you've come up with?
Well, it's a process of starting to look at and capture and document and extrapolate that which other people are using. And the easiest way to start is look at your own life. In your personal or your business life, what products or services have you purchased? And start not being abstract. Start
meaning
going,
consistently you've purchased
it? Doesn't matter.
Or?
It doesn't matter if it's consistently or one time. It's okay. Just something that compelled you to buy it. Then having a matrix where you start asking yourself, why did I buy it, first of all?
Okay.
So the next question is, what about that desire motivated me? Was it performance? Was it start getting deeper and deeper? What was the outcome or the result I was expecting? Number two, how did they convey that to me? Number three, what selling, what closure, what risk reversal, what illustrative methods did they use to induce me? And start asking yourself questions like that. That's one part of the matrix. The next part is every day of every week of every month of the rest of your life, make it a point to visit, call upon, stop, inquire from everybody you meet or know in business, at least two or three people a day, and ask them a couple of questions. Number one, how do you sell your product or service? More specifically, what's the most effective way your company has found to do it? What do you find to be the elements that make your sell the easiest to express? What is the selling philosophy you use? What is the basis you close your sells? What has impacted your selling strategy most? Then asking lots of questions, and then asking yourself as you're getting this and documenting it, what about that can I directly apply?
Exactly. How can I utilize this?
Right. What about it? If I can't directly apply it, what about it could I indirectly apply? If I can't directly or indirectly apply about it, what could
I? Who could?
That's right. Who could? And right. then ask yourself that. Then the final thing is take everybody in your field that is not a direct competitor. That means if you're a regional company, then make a list of everybody nationally who's not competing with you and call one of them every day and say, my name is Jay Abraham. We are not competitors. I will never be selling in Los Angeles. I'm in Chicago. If you're planning on selling in Chicago, please don't take my call. If you're not, I thought it'd be wise if we started a relationship where I shared with you what I've learned and what I do and compare it to you and ask you, what's the most successful selling technique you've done? What's the most effective relationship you've done? How do you guys do this? What is the most productive? And start, why should you recreate the wheel? Borrow from other people who've already done it. Next is if you then go to people who are in generically similar service businesses who do things not dissimilar. Then go outside and look at how other people totally and just pick people's minds. Asking questions, curiosity,
consummate
and investigating.
Modeler.
Well, no. But discovery in my mind, discovery is the fuel of competitive advantage. And you can't discover
nice.
Internally. You got to go
nice.
Outside because everyone in your business does things pretty much the same way. You don't want to know what your industry is doing, plus or minus 10%. You're already doing it. That's not where you talk about strategy. You had a comment, a parenthetical comment to me, which was accurate about if I don't change my strategy, I'm not going to get a different result. Well, it applies to these people too. No one in your industry is going to give you what you want. Everybody outside your industry is going to give you what you want because they've already stumbled accidentally upon all kinds of ways you can improve your business, all kinds of ways you can be more successful. They just don't know you want to know it. Ask them. They have nothing to lose by telling you, and they'll be so appreciative. Sometimes, if it's really important, I'll call somebody and offer them $100 for their time. None of them take it, but they're so flattered that somebody values them, they'll talk to you for 2 or 3 hours if you pick their mind. It's real easy. People make it so much harder than it has to be.
That's a core belief system that you have that seems to guide everything. Discovery is the fuel of competitive advantage. I like that. That's wonderful. Tell me, if a person is looking for a business right now, let's say, for example, they work for someone else and they really want to start their own business or they want to get in business, then how would you guide them to evaluate the type of business they would want to be in and the type of business they would not want to be in?
Well,
and I think earlier you said to me that you have some tools for how would you guarantee most businesses fail.
Yep.
How would you guarantee that a business would succeed?
First of all, is look to see what businesses have customers that they're not maximizing, that you could basically create a business which would be a joint venture relationship with them where you could take fullest advantage of the enormous investment they have already made, the enormous goodwill they have already established, the enormous money they are continually spending on facilities, on equipment, on personnel, on advertising, to sell or offer other logical extended products or services under the confines of the company. There's lots of examples. But basically, you find products or services. Most businesses I look at sell one product or service. All they think of themselves in the context of, I sell this product. When in fact, the very acquisition of that product means that a customer has to have pre-done one thing and then post-do something else to make usually that product work. It integrates with other products or services.
Okay.
All you got to do is say, what are the other products or services before and after they buy yours that they need or want? Find a way to make an association with somebody else who represents that. Come together with a company who sells one, do a joint venture with them, and you can make more money. Find somebody who's got a customer base and a great relationship, but they're only selling one facet of the process. Find other people who represent other needed aspects of the process. Make deals with them where you become their representative because you can deliver a market they don't have. Make a
based
joint
on associations you
yeah,
have or
that's a way to do
relationships.
It. Number two, if you're hell-bent on buying a franchise, don't buy the franchise until you do the following. First of all, talk to at least a dozen people who are unhappy. Talk to at least a dozen people who didn't buy the franchise. If the franchise people won't give you the names, then they probably don't have what they say, because if they got what they say, they should want you to have a balanced look. Then before you buy it, get the yellow pages from 50 markets and look under the generic category and see if other people have a generic equivalent. Call them up and ask them if you could visit them for free or for a fee. After you visit and look at them, see if they've got something which is as good and ask them if you could pay them a little bit of money to consult with you. There's lots of ways to get there without, so you hedge yourself. You can model something more successfully. Finally, if you're going to get into a franchise, most franchisees drop the ball on the most critical area. They don't give you marketing. They don't give you selling. They give you a system of operation, but you're on your own. Before you sign the dotted line, call at least 50 other franchisees and ask them to share with you the method they have of generating business. If they don't have a great method or combination method you can synthesize together, don't do it, because at most you're going to buy yourself a job and make less money and you won't have anything you can sell.
You've also said that you don't want people to buy a business that doesn't have a clear back end.
That's right. So. If you don't, you're exactly right. He's telling me my own business, and I thank you for it, because I'm getting punchy too. But the truth of, if it's a one-shot sale, you're not buying anything. It's your promotion, not a business. You want something where when you invest in a transaction, you have enormous amounts of future transactions you can predictably depend on, and you should think not just in terms of selling your product, but selling all kinds of other products or services. Most people think of themselves as being a widget maker or a service company. I think of you as being an ethical opportunist, and by that I mean your goal is to find as many ways to optimize the selling opportunities you have to that customer. Does that make sense?
Makes total sense.
It's very powerful.
Let me bring you back just one step here starting a business. What are the questions, because everybody can answer a question, that you would be asking entering a business to be able to create such a business as you've described? In other words, if I want to find a business, I want to find that need you're describing that I can fulfill.
Okay, ask yourself this question.
In a joint venture type of
situation. Okay, ask yourself this question. If you're looking for a system, a company that basically has a selling system that works but isn't begun to be optimized.
Right.
You're looking for a company that has enormous goodwill with customers that on their own accidentally and automatically are repurchasing over and over again but aren't being programmed. You're looking for a company that has at least one and hopefully multiple sources of revenue and that could easily adapt to multiple pillars that we're talking about. Okay, first thing I would do is, with permission, I would analyze the marginal net worth characteristics of the business. I would learn what's a customer worth, what predictably will they be worth, and then I'd ask myself this question. And you got to learn, and I didn't really give you a great education in this, but predictably, how many more ways can I extend the life of the customer? Because that's the surest way you've got to hedge. If you can't extend the life of the customer up and out, by that I mean for more money and more transactions ethically and more times, then it's very dangerous. If you can do that, then you almost are certain that it's a good investment.
How do you answer that question in a way that's measurable or quantifiable? Is there a way? Do you have a system?
Yeah, there is. First of all, you got to shop the business yourself. You got to ask permission in confidence, I guess, if they're the slightest bit apprehensive, with the warrant that you'll give them a release or a confidentiality statement, to call and talk to some of the customers as if you were a representative of the company. You got to find out for yourself firsthand, not through conjecture, what the goodwill is, what the loyalty is, what they see as the benefit, how much more leverage you've got in them by asking trial balloon questions so you can see how many more products or services or programming you can do with that customer, or whether their product or service are programmed out, or whether they're loyal or disloyal. And it's a process you've got to go with. It's a laborious. Most people are too eager to spend their money and commit their fate and their destiny
To a business they don't know enough about, and as a result, that's why two-thirds of them are going to fail.
That's right.
Interesting. So to answer the question directly then, the way that you make a 90% success ratio is you fully analyze and understand how to move the customer.
Non-emotionally.
I got it. Boy, that was pretty forceful.
Well, because I was thinking, most people make all their decisions from their heart. They have this vision of basically being a business owner. They have this decision of being happy. They have this decision of making money, and what they end up doing is creating a crumbling edifice that they can't even sell, and they have to run it, and it consumes them. It's horrible.
When they end up actually working harder than they ever did at a job for less money very often.
And their life savings are compromised.
Right.
See, exactly. I have a philosophy on all businesses which I want to make sure I can share with you because it's really important.
Do you have it to us now?
Whether J. Abraham ever comes in your life or not, you're the one who's consciously made the decision to invest your whole life, perhaps, you know, the fate of your family, the fate of all kinds of other families who are dependent directly or indirectly on you. You're the one who's got your house maybe mortgaged. You're the one who's got to get up every Monday morning and be in there to open the door. You're the one that has to make payroll, clear the bank. You're the one that's got your name on the line for the real estate. You owe it to yourself to do a couple of things. One, get the greatest yield out of everything you do. Two, get the greatest joy out of every hour you spend. Three, give the greatest value you can not only render, but that can be perceived, so you've got the greatest vehicle you're building so it can give you the greatest benefit you and it deserves. That's all.
You make owning a business sound, by contrast, not like something I would want to run out and do, even though I'm currently involved in it. What is the victory? What is the joy? What is the reward that owning your own business gives you? And why, and this seems like an inane question after all this discussion, but I'd like to hear you articulate it, why master marketing?
Well, first of all, whatever business you're in, you got to realize two things. You're not selling a business, you're selling a result, you're selling a benefit. Whether you like it or not, you're a sales and marketing company first and foremost. You are currently selling and marketing, whether you do it passively, where you do it reactively, whether you don't do it. That's what you're doing. Your marketing form, that your current preferred way of marketing may be no marketing, but you are a marketing company. See, you got to realize the greatest leverage you've got left in business is the following. I mean, no one's got any great competitive advantage. You can't buy that much cheaper. You can maybe put a second shift on. You can buy a piece of equipment, but by and large, there's no tax advantages. There's no great operational or managerial advantages you've got that give you high leverage. Marketing is the only way you've got available that can give you exponential leverage. Basically, most big corporations, big public corporations, they're tickled if they get a 20 or 25% ROI every year. Marketing can give you hundreds easily, thousands realistically, tens of thousands frequently of leverage on everything you do. Marketing is the vehicle that gives you distinction. Today in business, the system and business is trying to force everyone to accept being relegated to becoming a commodity. I submit to you, you don't have to succumb. You have the right to become a distinctive, preemptive, proprietary. You can only do that by being a supreme and a master marketer and an agile-minded innovator.
Wonderful. Well, tell me something. Why do you do what you do? I tend to end these interviews by asking people how they want to be remembered. I think you're going to be around a while, so I don't know if I can ask you that question. you got some spunk in you. But I'd like to know, why do you do what you do, and how do you want people to think about you or feel about you long term and what you've contributed?
The greatest acknowledgement I get is to watch people start smiling, to watch people become happy, to watch people change the way they look at their business, to watch people see their business as a vehicle they can make friends and impact others. That's one reason. Second, self-servingly. I learn so much from others. I grow exponentially every time I help people because I don't tell, I ask. I learn, so it's a combination. I believe the moment I stop growing, I regress and I atrophy, and I don't want to do that. I want to keep growing, and I can't grow if I don't keep helping, because when I help, I do it Socratically, and you only learn when you ask questions. That's pretty much it.
Well, Jay, I appreciate the time we spent together. We certainly spent more time than we thought originally, and I think you've given people a tremendous number of distinctions or answers, but hopefully what you've done is sparked within them even more questions, because as you've said, that's the way we're really going to learn, grow, and expand. And I appreciate it. If people have questions about how to reach you and avail themselves of your services, can you give me a phone number or a way for them to contact you?
Sure. They can call my office in Los Angeles. The number is
1-800-635-6298.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Thank you. I've had a wonderful time with you, and I'm looking forward to hearing many stories from people who utilize what they've heard on this tape to make quantum leaps, exponential leaps, in the quality of what they do for people and for themselves simultaneously.
That would please me too, Tony. Thank you very much.